You're back with RCR and climate specials that we've been wanting to bring to you for some time. This is going to be our session two with Ian McIntosh, who has a Bachelor of Applied Sciences and Rural Technology with honours. He gave his first talk, his first 27 slides of his talk, actually, earlier this month. But to recap, we went over his simple premise that destroys the despair that the climate change narrative is giving all of us, really. And he gave his reasons why that was. So he said that the despair is because we're told that man is destroying the planet via global warming by burning fossil fuels. This commenced in 1750 with the advent of the Industrial Revolution. And he said, but fortunately, this is very easy, a very easy claim to test. And that's because we have temperature records from 100 years before the Industrial Revolution. And so he concluded session one by saying that obviously we didn't cause the gradual rise in temperature, and even the IPCC says that at most we have caused a 1% warming effect. Privately, I think that's even overstated. But Ian, welcome back, and we're going to start on session two, and that's going to say basically expose if we didn't cause the increase, what did? So it's over to you, Ian. I know you're going to screen share, and we'll work from here.
Okay, well, I'll go and share my screen.
All good.
All right, can you see that?
Absolutely.
Perfect. Very good. All right, well, I'll give a very quick summary of what we concluded in set of session one. So for those who didn't see this last time, these are the oldest temperature records on the planet from central England. It commenced in 1659, soon after the thermometer was invented. And ironically, these records were taken in the very part of the world where the Industrial Revolution started, which was in 1750. So, there we are. So here's a line drawn straight through the middle. If you've got your computer to draw a line through that data, this is what it would look like, and it's linear. That's important to take account of. And in 1750, you'll see here, that's when the Industrial Revolution started. And you'll also see that 90 odd years prior to the Industrial Revolution, the temperature was already increasing from a low, and it's continued on at that linear rate even to today. And of course, the burning of fossil fuels in 1750 is being blamed on, or at least the commencement of, is being blamed for the temperature increase. But you can see there for yourself, the temperature was already increasing for 90 years prior. Now, this is the comparison with the amount of carbon dioxide that man has emitted. And again, we see the start of the Industrial Revolution in 1750. And there's the figures up to today. And that's an increase of 371,500%. And I stress it's exponential increase in CO2 in the amount of carbon dioxide we've released versus a linear increase in temperature. So you can clearly see that the burning of fossil fuels has had no impact whatsoever on the linear temperature increase that we've seen since
And
sixteen fifty-nine.
the linear is barely a degree that I see, whereas the increase in the CO2 emissions is 371,500%. Surely there's a
Absolutely.
comparison there, Ian.
Absolutely. And Jasper, I think that's a really important thing to note, because the line through the middle is the average of 1961 to 1990. And what you're saying is that we're starting down at around negative 0.7 of a degree centigrade, and we're going up to about 0.5, 0.6. So we're talking about 1.3 degrees increase. And of course, people are talking about 1.5 degrees as being catastrophic. Well, you can see for yourself. Those are all small numbers accumulated over a long period of time, and man's not going to have any influence whatsoever on the trajectory of that line. So we've concluded that man's emissions have had zero or negligible effect on the linear rate of increase of the Earth's temperature. The official narrative is therefore wrong. So that's great news. But of course, what we want to know is why was that line Why did it start so low, relatively low to start with? And tonight we're going to understand why that happened and the excellent evidence we've got to explain that. So if we didn't cause the increase in temperature that we've got there, well, what did? And why was it so cold to start with? So this is the information we've got, eyewitness accounts. Now, the thing I want to stress is that people have got all sorts of theories, and you can just go down and find five farmers talking over a fence about stuff, and they're as good as anybody, and they'll all have theories. But until you put objective evidence on the table, you're not going to guide a good conclusion that will actually make any sense. So I always stick to eyewitness reports. Well, this is on an eyewitness report. Paintings have got dates written on them. So this is a painting of the Frozen Thames in 1677. And this is from a historic record, and it says, during the great winter of 1683 to 84, where even the seas of southern Britain were frozen solid for up to 2 miles from shore, the most famous frost fair was held. The frost fairs were held on the frozen Thames every year. So we've got an eyewitness account of the frozen Thames since 1607. So if we go and overlay that eyewitness information with the temperature records, you can see that the cold period that the thermometers are recording is being validated by the physical evidence of the Thames freezing every year.
Yes.
And so it's important that when you've got data, you validate it. Well, we've been able to validate it. And the last frost fair was held in 1814. And the reason given was that the weather or the climate was warming. So the winters weren't nearly so severe, and the ice was no longer strong enough on the Thames to sustain a frost fair. So that was the last one. So on that basis, we can now draw a line understanding where in
The warming again.
1814, why they no longer had a frost fair. Well, it was because the temperatures increased, and it got to a point where it simply wasn't cold enough. And again, our graph is validated by the eyewitness accounts. Well, the Thames is not the only ice that we've got eyewitness accounts of. This is ice in Glacier Bay in Alaska. Now, fortunately, people have been recording where the ice was since 1750. And as you'll be aware by now, the Industrial Revolution commenced in 1750. So we're lucky enough to have two accounts of what the climate was relative to the Industrial Revolution. So you'll see lines on that graph of red lines or orange lines, and that's eyewitness accounts of where the ice was. And one of the blokes who was involved in this is a fellow called George Vancouver. So if we read the commentary on the left-hand side there, it says, by 1750, the glacier reached its maximum, jutting into Icy Strait. But 45 years later, when Captain George Vancouver sailed here, the glacier had melted back 5 miles into Glacier Bay. Now, for those people who've travelled into Glacier Bay by these passenger liners today, they come through Icy Strait and they go up inside Glacier Bay. Well, in 1450, the ice extended out into Icy Strait, and some of that ice was recorded as being 1,200 metres above sea level. That's significant ice. But what's interesting, 45 years later, when George Vancouver came along, the ice had already melted back inside Glacier Bay. So something was happening right back there in 1750, and man had only just started the Industrial Revolution. So by 1880, well, the ice had dramatically melted. So when conservationist John Muir came here in 1879, the glacier had retreated 40 more miles up the bay since Vancouver's visit. And of course, we'll see where the ice is today. Well, if we go and overlay that data onto our temperature record, the oldest temperature records in the world, this is what we see. So again, the eyewitness accounts that we see around the world tie in very closely with the temperature records that were recorded in England. And again, you'll see if everything We've got a nice straight line with our temperature increase having a direct impact on the world's glaciers back as early as 1750. And yet the alarmists today are saying that we must have caused it. Well, we couldn't have caused it because it was already happening and most of it had gone by 1880. We'd barely started the Industrial Revolution by then. So with so much melting that was happening in Glacier Bay, well, what about other parts of the world? Let's see if we can go and explain what's been happening in the Arctic. Well, there's Glacier Bay on that map. There's the North Pole. And these records began, records of the Arctic and Antarctic sea ice, but I'm talking here specifically about the Arctic. The Arctic sea ice records began in 1979. It was Professor John Christie with his colleague who put a satellite into space that's been recording the Earth's lower atmospheric temperature since 1979. Professor Christie was with NASA at the time, and he won with his colleague a prestigious science award for putting that satellite into space. And as a result of a satellite being in space, they also started recording the sea ice in the Arctic and the Antarctic. And so what we've got here is records of that pink line was where the ice was in 1979. And in 2021, you'll see the actual ice, which is in white. And this graph reflects the loss of ice between the pink line and the white line. And that's a significant drop of 7.4% loss of ice per decade. So we can see in the Northern Hemisphere on the Thames and in Glacier Bay and in Alaska, there's been loss of ice. But it started back around 1750 before man started to release a lot of carbon dioxide. So in other words, the loss of light, the loss of ice in the Northern Hemisphere and glaciers in New Zealand, etc., was happening before man could have caused it. So for people to say that man is the cause, our emissions are the cause of loss of ice today, is not validated by the historic information.
But yet, Ian, we hear often how in New Zealand, the glaciers are receding, the glaciers are advancing, the glaciers are receding, all in our lifetime.
Yeah.
So we're very conveniently disposed to bite-sized bits of information rather than these long-term data sets. And I think that seems to be at our peril. I think that's what you're inferring.
Well, absolutely. And if you want to say we're causing the loss of sea ice, well, you've got to explain the historic data. And there's no other way to do it, which is man could not have caused it.
Gentlemen, are you aware that this year, 2025, is the first year that the United Nations has declared an International Day of Glacier Preservation, which is 21st of March. So the first one was celebrated this year. And you can just see how the narrative is kept alive.
Yeah, I know. And it's kept alive because people aren't considering all the data.
You don't know history.
Yeah, they don't know history. And people have not done, either they've done it, done the objective analysis, as we're talking about here, and discounted it because it's not convenient, or they haven't done the work. Well, if they haven't done the work, they're inept.
Very clearly so.
Yeah.
Well, and if clearly... former Vice President Al Gore talked about the inconvenient truths. Well, he was obviously scared of truths, convenient or inconvenient. Inconvenient to him. That's what I would posit, Ian.
Yeah.
These people have made a lot of money out of this convenience that they've created.
Yeah, 100%. In fact, this was one of the data that I got on the sea ice in the Arctic and the Antarctic was one of those bits of information when I came across it, made me aware that there's something terribly wrong with the message I was getting in the media.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, this is now, I'm probably going back about 7 odd years now. And every time I've checked the data that I've heard via the media or academics, sadly, consistently I've found that we're not getting told the truth. And that's the beauty of now being able to share this the way we are, is that so people can go on and check this out, because all of my information is referenced. And they can go and check this out for themselves. Every day the new data is uploaded. So don't take my word for it. Go and check it for yourself. Now, this is the amazing bit. This next slide. So Antarctica has 90% of the world's ice. And I'm not going to show it here, but you can find it. There's a reference there that'll show it. Every year, the amount of ice, sea ice, that melts and regrows is an area over twice the size of Australia. Now,
Right.
I grew up in Australia, and I've driven across Australia. It takes 5 days, big days, to drive from Perth to Sydney. I've also driven up the coast from Sydney north, but if you start down in Melbourne and go to Cape York, you're probably talking 6 days. Now, if you work out the area of Australia and double it, that's the amount of ice that melts and regrows every year in Antarctica. So I don't know why the media keep talking about these big icebergs that fall off, and it's sign of bad news, when in fact what they should be saying to the kids, look, it's going to regrow again. And in fact, when you have a look at this information, the sea ice is actually slowly growing by 0.6 of a percent per decade. Right? Now, we know that in the last 2 years, we did get a significant melt, but that came out of the Tongan earthquake, submarine earthquake. Sorry, volcano. And that volcano put a lot of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere via way of water vapor, which is the most potent greenhouse gas. And volcanoes typically have about 2 year effect on the climate. And so people might say, well, Ian, you haven't taken the latest data. Well, no, I haven't. But we can easily explain that. And things are returning back to normal in Antarctica. But we've got an extensive period of time here, 40 odd years. And it shows us a slight increase. So where the bulk of the ice is on the planet, we are not seeing a decline in ice.
And
And this
that's
is
also the pole, if I'm not mistaken, where they have a lot of volcanoes under the
they
water,
do.
under
They
the
do,
ice,
absolutely.
Antarctica. So this is, despite that, we have a regret there.
Totally. Totally. Right. So we know the glaciers have been receding since at least 1750. So let's summarize the data to date. And since then, the world's ice has been melting, except in Antarctica, where 90% of the world's ice is. And this in part explains why sea level has been slowly increasing, as shown in Brest in France in 1807. Now, I make particular reference here to thermal expansions of the oceans. Now, it was Professor Happer who picked me up a few weeks ago, and he said, Ian, your graph implies, which I'm going to show you now, your graph implies that that's all due to the melting of glaciers and the reduction in sea ice in the Arctic. But he said, in fact, a reasonable amount of the rise in sea level comes from thermal expansion that is coming directly from the temperature increase that is happening naturally anyway. So we've got melting of glaciers, melting of the Arctic sea ice, and thermal expansion, and they're all contributing to that graph. Now, what's interesting is I said last time, there are hundreds of these graphs, and they're all linear.
This one, Ian, is showing a 1 mm with a bit of plus minus sea level rise per year.
1.04 millimeters per year. And I said last time, Lyttelton's 2.9. Off the top of my head, Sydney's about 1.55. But this is all around the world. You're getting a linear increase. Some places it's a linear increase decrease because the ice is melting. In Scandinavia, for example, Norway, there are places up there where the ice is melting, and the land rises up with less weight on it, and you get a negative sea level rise. But this is the dominant theme all around the world.
And yet, I mean, I'll put in a plug in here for Alistair Harding's work on his recent documentary, Manage Out on RCR, that premiered last week. We have councils up and down this country trying to push people into a managed retreat, a community-led managed retreat, because somehow the oceans are going to, seas are going to rise and swallow us up by the end of the century. If you look at this graph, that just puts paid to that nonsense.
Well, the good thing is, Jaspreet, is that every graph we've looked at is linear. So there are no nasty surprises coming. We can look back 365 odd years and see the temperature's been slowly increasing linearly. We go back to 1807, so 200 odd years of sea level rise in France. That's linear. So why are we going to expect anything that's not linear as we progress?
For the listener, when we speak linear, Ian is referring to slow and steady. So when you get projections of dramatic increases over the next few decades, they do not, they are based on models that do not correspond with what our reality has been to date, Ian.
Yeah, no, that's right. And of course, linear means a straight line. So through here, that line there is linear. And you'll remember earlier when we were talking about the carbon emissions by man, it was exponential. The graph went like that. If you can see my mouse.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. All right. So clearly something was happening back in the 1600s to explain why we ended up with all that ice. Well, I'm going to give you the reason for that ice. You'll remember we looked at that slide.
Yes.
Well, the reason why we ended up with a very cold period in the early 1600s is what's called the Little Ice Age. And I had no idea about the Little Ice Age up until about 5 years ago. And I dare say most people don't. I was certainly never taught it at school, and I've never heard it. You rarely hear about it, but increasingly I'm finding expert commentators specifically mentioning the Little Ice Age. And it's good because that is a key point in our history, and we can understand what caused the Little Ice Age. So I'm going to share that with you now. And here it is. Now, here's 400 years of sunspot observations. Now, a fellow called Galileo was helping to collect this data. He was a smart chap. And you got to take your hat off to these fellows. Back in the early 1600s, how did they see sunspots? Well, they certainly didn't look at them with a naked eye. They had techniques, and they used things like prisms to refract the light, and they'll be able to observe things on the page, dots on an A4 page, for example. And this is their record. So these go back to the early 1600s. And when we compare sunspot activity with temperature, the oldest temperature records in the world, what do we see? The period of least sunspot activity correlates directly with our lowest temperatures.
Which would seem logical.
Absolutely. Now, if we go and now record the sunspot activity, these are a series of three slides. So this is 1610 to 1740. And here's the equator of the sun. And this is sunspot activity as you move away from the equator. You'll see the early 1600s, there was a little bit. Tiny amounts right through the center of the coldest period of the Little Ice Age. We go to the next period. All of a sudden, the sunspot activity increases dramatically. So this is up until 1875. And there you are, 2020.
Right.
So to go back, we can now clearly see these blue lines here, basically a summary of all of those little dots. Down here, these red dots are individual figures because there weren't many sunspots, but they couldn't put all the little dots here as individuals. They just compiled them as a total to give us the blue lines. The sunspot activity was huge compared to this period back in here in the morning minimums. So it makes total sense. We're just fortunate that we've got people who kept their records, and we're fortunate that we've got the modern internet where you can stumble across the sort of information. The data's been there, but I didn't know about it.
And I don't think the word sunspot enters the average person's lexicon. I certainly haven't seen it in any of our documents in the country predicting what our climate is going to be by 2100. Can you predict sunspots, Ian?
No, not a hope.
You cannot. So how are we trying to mitigate against all of this?
I know. You hear about flares,
solar
flares, etc. But no, I'm certainly not a physicist. And fair to say that with that amount of information and this amount of variation that we're seeing, in sunspot activity, you'd need to be a very, very smart man to be able to predict that. So therefore, totally with what you're saying, Jaspreet, we're not going to be able to predict what happens in the next 100 years.
You know, who knows? We have these people, Ian, who want to do SRM courses, solar radiation management. What do they want to do? I don't know. It is beyond the capability of a mortal like me, but they certainly seem to be conceited enough to think they can manage all of this, control all of this.
Yeah, well, it might be a good question for Professor Happel or one of his colleagues to say, can we predict sunspot activity? But at this point, the good news is that it's an explanation, a part explanation for why our temperatures were so low. But there's some more information that indicates why our temperatures were so low, and it's the volcanic activity. So the Journal of Volcanology and Geothermal Research there compares a comparison with various climatic records suggest that periods of frequent and violent volcanic eruptions coincided with cold climatic conditions. For example, the highest volcanic activity since 1553 occurred in AD 1250 to 1500 and AD 1550 to 1700s. In other words, in the initial and culminating phases of the Little Ice Age. Those aren't my words. That's taken straight out of the journal. Dr. Gifford Miller led a team of scientists from the University of Colorado at Boulder, USA, and he is quoted on BBC. You'll see there the reference, and he says a series of eruptions just before 1300 lowered Arctic temperatures enough for ice sheets to expand, and this would have kept the Earth cool for centuries. He believes that the Little Ice Age had volcanic origins. He goes on with his colleagues, 2012, they use radiocarbon dating of mosses that emerged from underneath the ice in Baffin Island, and sediment caused from Iceland suggested that the trigger for the Little Ice Age was likely a combination of exploding tropical volcanoes, which ejected tiny aerosols that reflected sunlight back into space, and a decrease in solar radiation. So, if we summarize that, the Little Ice Age created a cold period between 1600 and 1800. That was caused by significant volcanic activity and reduction in sunspots. Recovery back to temperature homeostasis, in other words, back where the physics means that the temperature doesn't go up or down. You know, things have stabilized. So recovery back to that point, sorry, recovery back to temperature homeostasis is the cause of the slow rise in the annual temperature. And any attempts by man to reduce emissions will only cause economic hardship, especially for the poor middle class, and have zero impact on temperature rise and climate. And anybody harping on about the world reaching new record highs is not aware of the slow linear increase in temperature since before the Industrial Revolution, which means that we will regularly set new records that will happen irrespective of man. So, New Zealand Climate Change Commission says that in the face of the sharpening climate challenge, the world is intensifying efforts to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in ways that will sustain and keep their communities safe. Aotearoa New Zealand has committed to this global response and is building its own, oh, I can't see what that word is up there,
Transition.
so
Transition.
transition to a thriving low emissions economy. I've seen no evidence that if you remove carbon emissions or a low emissions economy, you end up with a thriving economy. There is zero evidence of that, and there's plenty of evidence of bad news. So the Climate Change Commission has got no understanding of the truth. So here's my conclusion. If man has not caused a noticeable increase in temperature and is not causing acidifications of the oceans or droughts, which is what we saw in my session one, or floods or intensity of rain or increased sea level rise, then how can man justify spending anything on reducing emissions and expect to see a humanitarian, financial, or environmental return? And in session three, we will see that using fossil fuels is actually very good for feeding the Earth's population. So, what I like about the information I've discovered is that there's good news, and good news. There is no mention of despair. Young people, old people, farmers, people who are lay people and just take what they're told in the media as being truth, they can have a look at the data for themselves. It is all good news, And session three is going to deliver a double dose of good news, particularly for farmers and those interested in sustainable agriculture, which I am. So thank you for the chance to deliver this one.
Yeah, fantastic, Ian. Look, we do await session three. We're right at the end of time for this one, but we didn't get many questions in because you're on a roll, and we appreciate it because the story is compelling. So thank you for letting us have your knowledge on session two, and we'll see you for session three in a few weeks.
Great. Thanks very much, Don and Jaspreet. Look forward to it.
Thank you so much, Ian. And for our listeners, the slides for this will be uploaded, and they're pretty clear ones, should be self-explanatory, but we welcome any feedback. 2057 is our number, or you can email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. Thank you so much for joining us today.